Welcome to Lost River Legends. Our motto, Ex Tenebris, is Latin for out of the shadows. We attempt to understand the complex world around us and bring light to subjects hidden in darkness. We explore paranormal topics with guests from all around the world. Now welcome your Lost River Legends hosts, James and Brett. We hope you enjoy the show.
This episode of Lost River Legends. Thank you for being here. In this episode, James and I talk with Joshua Cutchin. Joshua is very well-rounded when it comes to the world of the paranormal. He's able to research and process and discuss just about anything in the field. Joshua has solidified his investigative skills for focusing on the castaway or never discussed odd topics of the paranormal and diving really deep with them. As he does this, he sheds a never-before-seen light on the odd facets of this phenomenon. For example, in one of his books, titled The Brimstone Deceit, Joshua writes about odors and smells associated with the paranormal, like spiritual encounters, UFOs, and Sasquatch. Joshua has been on Coast to Coast AM multiple times. He has appeared on the television series Ancient Aliens, and has appeared on podcasts like Strange Familiars and Sasquatch Chronicles. Today, we invited Joshua onto Lost River Legends to discuss the djinn, D-J-I-N-N. Djinn, or the anglicized version, genie, are supposedly supernatural creatures in the pre-Islamic mythology and theology. In some accounts, these creatures are, or were, part of the creation, and are neither inherently good, nor are they inherently evil. However, many witness accounts of these beings lean towards them being malevolent. They have been known to appear as animals like snakes, owls, and black dogs, or even as sandstorms or mists in the desert. These creatures are also tied to wizardry and even witchcraft. And some stories tell of ancient sorcerers conjuring the djinn into existence and forcing the being to perform orders. Today, we talk about these creatures in an attempt to understand if they're merely haunted spirits in another part of the world, or if there's something more sinister and dark going on. And even though our primary focus on this episode is the djinn, we do talk about other subjects during our conversation. We hope you enjoy this episode, and we thank you for listening to Lost River Legends.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. We'd like to get into the subject of the djinn, and there's a lot of different spellings of that. And I noticed, I was like, okay, I don't know if I'm even Googling this right, but I do see it like D-J-I-N-N, J-I-N-N, and then kind of like a J-I-N-N-E, like genie, genie.
Yeah, that's largely a function of trying to render Arabic words into English. You sort of run into the same thing with the Quran. You'll see the Quran spelled K-O-R-A-N or Q-U-R-A-N. And it really, I don't think there's any consensus on how best to spell it. I kind of do like the D-J-I-N-N because it sort of retains that, you know, the J sound, the sort of D-G, Django Reinhardt sort of thing. But, you know, I've seen it written J-I-N-N, J-I-N-N-I-E. And, you know, obviously G-E-N-N-I-E or G-E-N-I-E.
So that's super interesting. And just talking about the language. So, like, it seems like that this centers around the Arabic language and might even have origins kind of before that morphed out of that. Or is it just...
Well, you know, I don't know if I can say for certain, but there is a lot of mixing and matching and conflation and sort of melting pot with a lot of these beliefs, especially pre-Islamic beliefs, because, you know, there were ideas about the djinn that existed before, you know, Islam incorporated them into sort of their larger cosmology. So you've got to also sort of look at a lot of, you know, Zoroastrian texts, the Avesta, stuff like that. I don't know if the etymology is settled on exactly where it comes from or what it means. I've heard some stuff saying that it means, you know, insanity, or like, you know, the idea of something like the germ of life, like an embryo or something. But I'm not sure if that's settled either.
Very interesting. Yeah. In some of my studying up on it, it's interesting because there is this idea that they are a creation, you know, something that, you know, when we talk about the biblical creation, that they were kind of in parallel. I also heard something about them being, you know, sitting outside the gates of heaven and eavesdropping. So kind of some of those are kind of the basic ideas of where they come from.
Yeah, I'm going to make a blanket statement here, and I'm sure that somebody listening is going to take some degree of offense at it, because that's what we do in our culture nowadays. But without arguing the superiority of one culture over another, I do think you can broadly say that if you can apply something to, you know, Western European fairy lore, it kind of pretty much will apply to, you know, djinn lore. And this applies to sort of the ways that they behave, and also applies to the sort of food that they allegedly consume, the sort of areas where they hang out. Even though ghosts are sort of a big no-no from what I understand in Islam, there are some pre-Islamic indicators that the djinn were tied to the spirits of the dead, which is something that you also find a lot in Irish fairy lore as well. So you can kind of roughly draw comparisons between any aspect of the two. But, you know, djinn even steal children and replace them with changelings, which is, you can take some stories from like Iraq and swap out all the proper nouns and with, you know, something from, you know, County Tipperary in Ireland, and you've got the same story as a changeling story in terms of the way that the child is taken away and the way that the child's brought back and stuff. So it really is striking in that regard. But I say all that to say that I would suspect that, like fairy lore, a lot of the stories that we hear about what these things objectively are very much tied in with the way that the dominant religion of the area would syncretize these older, sort of, for lack of a better term, pagan beliefs. So in the case of the fairies of Ireland, it was always, you know, oh, well, they're the angels that were too good for hell but too bad for heaven, or the angels who didn't choose to pick a side. But really, those are all sort of ways of trying to fit square pegs and round holes in terms of taking this older lore and fitting into an existing cosmology. So you'll hear some stuff that talks about, you know, the djinn part perhaps being angels, or the djinn perhaps being created alongside man at the same time, this form of, you know, smokeless fire. Which is, you know, really interesting, and I don't discredit those, but I also have to sort of put those within a context that says that they're probably picking up on a lot of older lore that's probably related more to stuff like spirits of the land, these sort of areas where you'd bury the revered dead. You know, you'd bury a chieftain of some sort at an area, and over the generations, that chieftain would sort of become like the spirit of that area, and then sort of become a nature spirit, and there's a whole sort of process behind that you see in a lot of different cultures. So one of the djinn, your guess is as good as mine. The official answer is you know, related to angels, like you said, or that smokeless fire that you see in the Quran description.
So that actually, you answered a lot of the questions I had about kind of the geographical and the cultural boundaries. You know, it's kind of funny. It's like almost like, okay, does it stop at Constantinople and then just get called something else as you move west? You know, like, is there a line of delineation where it's like,
no, I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, for some reason, a lot of my work centers around this fairy folklore, and because I do think it has a lot of, not explicative power, but it's a good model for which we can look at a lot of unexplained phenomena. And it's not just, you know, when you say fairy folklore, people think Western Europe, maybe they'll think about Scandinavia as well, but it really is something that's a worldwide phenomena, and it does extend beyond those borders. Although I would say that the most and this might be a function of where our cultures come from in the West, but I would say that the most codified set of beliefs around these fairy-like figures, Jewish Shadim or the Jinn or you know, the fairies in a lot of these countries, elves, etc., do come from the Abrahamic religions for sure.
So as you try to kind of classify or look at parallels, what are some of the characteristics that you're seeing that have that crossover? You did talk kind of like that smoke without fire, but there's some other stories out there of possession, of embodiment, that kind of thing. Can you share anything along those lines?
Yeah, so there is a tendency for jinn to inhabit uninhabited areas, ruins, also be associated with a particular place, which lines up with Western European fairy folklore. What they consume is usually looked at as, you know, detritus or some sort of filth. Again, we see that same thing. It's usually detritus or filth that's been, you know, made to look like delicious food. And in Western Europe, that would be, the fairy's glamour. They'd be glamour something to make it appear as something that it's not. There is that association with the dead that I mentioned earlier in some of the pre-Islamic jinn folklore. Shapeshifters, so it's something you see all across all paranormal phenomena, I would argue, also into the Bigfoot world a bit, and definitely into the world of alien abductions, this idea that these things can shapeshift or, you know, alter your memory somehow. There's the changeling aspect, which is not restricted to fairies either. You can draw parallels between changelings, these children who are stolen and replaced with babies. You can draw parallels between that and a lot of the alien abduction folklore, and even some especially Eurasian wild man folklore, where the wild men would take a human baby and leave a wild man baby behind. There is that aspect of possession, not as well known in Western European fairy folklore, but it does happen more than one would expect. The ability to manifest raps and knocks. Some of the things that I think set them apart a little bit are their... So I mentioned that some of these older beliefs are sort of picked up and syncretized by these dominant religions as they move in and replace these older, more animistic style beliefs. And what's interesting about the jinn is that, unlike the fairies in Christianity, the way that Christianity dealt with the fairies, the jinn are in the Quran. Like, you know, they're like about 30 times or so, I think. Whereas, you know, there obviously aren't fairies by name in the Bible. So we do have a little bit more of a structured system around that. And because of that, we do have an idea of how they fit in with sort of the ecology of souls that we look at. In terms of their hierarchy, kind of thinking them as somewhere between humans and angels is probably a pretty good way to think of them. There's an interesting component to the jinn that you don't see in fairy folklore as much, and that's their association to become sort of attached to an object, which is probably where we get the genie in a bottle, genie in a lamp sort of folklore coming from, or that sort of popular culture conception. I have not, to my knowledge, found that association with fairy folklore. But having said that, if you look at a lot of different places around the world, there are certain areas where it's ill-advised to take something home. You know, I'm thinking specifically like people who visit some of the volcanoes in Hawaii are told, you know, don't take a piece of the volcano home, don't take the rock home, or else you'll be followed by the spirits of Maui who will wreak havoc with your life. And one of the things with some of these Hawaiian national parks is that they just get loads and loads of rocks mailed back to them because people take them into their homes and they cause all sorts of havoc. So that you don't see in the Western European fairy folklore, but it does sort of speak to a larger trend, broader trend of sort of spirit phenomena in general.
Very interesting. It's interesting that attachment to objects, almost, you know, historically we think of that as like, there's some associative property or some, like with the genie, there's a contain, you know, it can be contained in this thing and activated on, you know, based on, you know, the rubbing of the lamp. Yeah, I think that's kind of more, doesn't that come from the Aladdin original writing of Aladdin, or kind of the mythology behind that?
Yeah, so I think that, so there's this trend in the paranormal, which gets really tiresome, but at the same time, I understand where it comes from. And that's the tendency for people to jump to the conclusion that everything's a demon, you know, everything's demons, right? But on some level, I kind of agree in the sense that everything really is everything. So the stuff that you'll find in demon folklore is in fairy folklore, is in a lot of this alien abduction stuff. The problem is that people go in under the assumption that their idea of a demon is the true form of whatever these things are. And I think you've got to say, well, these are all describing similar phenomena, but you know, as to whether or not anyone has a monopoly on exactly what these things are, that's the real question. So I think you do find sort of an antecedent to the genie in a bottle sort of idea with a lot of the ideas that you'd find in the medieval era of being able to keep a demon or a devil in a box, you know, sometimes bound with certain materials. If you knew the name of a demon or a devil, you could write it on a sheet of paper and stick it in a box and do a magic spell, and it would bind the demon to this box. And by that means, you could control it or, you know, contain it. But the stories that you hear, you know, and I wish that I had more off the top of my head. But the stories that I've read by people like, you know, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, a lovely, lovely lady. I had the chance to meet her, and she did a lot of work on the djinn before her death. And a lot of the stories that you'll hear contemporarily are like people picking up items from a bazaar in, you know, Mahmoudia or something, and they'll come home and you'll have poltergeist phenomena all around the house. Because poltergeist phenomena follows all these things all the time, for sure. So yeah, I guess that might be where a lot of this comes from. But yeah, it's really interesting. You know, Rosemary she kind of got into this place before she died, where I had a friend say it's almost like she was like the Giorgio Tsoukalos of djinn, like therefore djinn. But, you know, I don't completely agree with that statement, but I kind of see what he meant, because she was tying a lot of stuff into that. But she wasn't the only person to sort of do that. A lot of the old issues of Flying Saucer Review periodical from the last century, more or less, there was a gentleman by the name of Gordon Crichton, who was sort of the chief editor, and he had a lot of stuff that he would always point to for the UFO phenomena resembling a lot of djinn folklore. And of course, if we look at the djinn being expressive of fairy folklore, then we're kind of back to the point where, you know, how much of this stuff really does correspond to these sort of worldwide fairy traditions that we see.
Right. And over here, we might just have a different, you know, modern name for it. You know, shadow people, Catman, that kind of stuff. You know, is it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's interesting. And I'm glad you brought that up, because you see much more of an association of the djinn with things like shadow people in modern contexts than you do, you know, fairy folklore. I do know there was I mentioned, you know, Rosemary and Gordon Crichton, but there was also some work by the late Anne Druffel, who I remember in one of her books was about how to, you know, thwart alien abductions, described some situations that sounded like, depending on the way that you interpreted them, would be either a shadow person or sleep paralysis if, you know, you're a materialist, or alien abduction, or a ghost, or a demon, or a djinn if you have a new Muslim. And there was a young man in one of these stories who was indeed Muslim. And he, interestingly enough, had this experience where he was in bed. He saw this shape with his red eyes that was sort of creeping up towards him. And he reached out and prayed for the intercession of Muhammad the Prophet. And it worked. And what's interesting is that anyone who tends to have an experience like that, who reaches out to a, you know, a spiritual personage, whatever it might be, generally has pretty good results with getting the activity, at least in the moment there, to go away, generally speaking. But what's interesting is it responds to Jesus, Muhammad, the higher self, you know, any number of things that you want to pray to, it seems to respond to. So that brings into question whether, you know, we have some sort of all religions are true thing, or the idea that that somehow there's some sort of inner aspect of belief or intention that is able to interact with whatever these phenomena are. You know, and now I'm sure that the reductionist idea is like, oh, he had sleep paralysis and he was anxious, so he prayed to himself and that gave him comfort and that, you know, made whatever it was go away. But I certainly don't fall into that camp all the time.
You know, and it reminds me of an episode on the Confessionals with Tony Merkel, where he had a guest on who was a MUFON investigator. His name is Joe Jordan. And interestingly enough, the actual title of the episode is Abduction Stopped in the Name of Jesus. So people, you know, pray in this instance in the name of Jesus, and any abduction activity or any abduction that's in process seemingly stops. And so it kind of has an interesting correlation with what you're talking about there.
Yeah, Joe Jordan has done a lot of stuff talking about that sort of thing. And I know that Guy Malone is another guy who's sort of UFO inclined, who thinks that there's a spiritual angle to it. I'm in this weird position as someone who is a practicing Christian, who nonetheless thinks that a lot of the Christian, like strict Christian interpretations of this phenomena are a little bit narrow-minded. You know, this idea that everything is good or evil. You know, I tend to think that we're dealing with something that's a little bit more like, again, an ecology of spirits, an ecology of souls, where there are some things that are free agents that could be for good or for evil, or there are some things out there that aren't necessarily evil, but can still mess you up if you don't approach them with respect, or, you know, you catch them on a bad day, sort of like sharks, right? A shark is an evil shark, but a shark is gonna shark, like a friend of mine once said. So, yeah, and, you know, I know you guys are interested in Bigfoot, and there is, I wouldn't say it's a common thing, because I don't know how often people see Bigfoot and pray, but there is a light thread through some Bigfoot accounts where prayer does make them leave, or in some cases disappear. I know that was the case in at least one of the encounters around the Beast of Whitehall, in Whitehall, New York. And then I think, you know, we mentioned the Confessionals. I know that's occurred a couple times on Sasquatch Chronicles as well. Wes Germer has talked about some people having similar experiences with being able to sort of pray Bigfoot away. But what does that mean? You know, is it coincidence that these things leave? Well, again, sometimes I think in the case of the Beast of Whitehall, when the police, I think it was a police officer or a security guard, if memory serves, when he prayed, the thing just literally vanished. I don't know what to do with that, but I also don't think that, you know, we should throw it out as being silly or being, you know, a fiction just because we don't like it. You know, I think we got to at least sit with it and acknowledge that it exists and not necessarily ridicule it, because it is consistent with stuff like what Jordan is saying, well, other people.
I think those are all really valid points. I think about what you were saying about intention. I think that has so much to do with a lot of what happens with a lot of different situations, whether good or bad, or, you know, and like you said before, like assigning it to the good, you know, good or evil camp. Well, there's also this other, you know, I think of it as like good, evil, and other, like question mark.
Unassigned.
Undetermined.
Yeah, no, I like that, and I really am, I resonate strongly with what you said about the idea that intention plays a role. I mean, so your mileage, like mine, certainly, may vary on Stephen Greer. I think that's a polite way of saying it for me, but I talk to people who have done these CFETI meetings, who they're calling down UFOs with their minds or their intelligence, and it seems to have some degree of consistency in the way that it works, at least with them getting what appear to not be satellites and not be the space station and not be airplanes. I've talked to some people who are like, no, this was really strange. So there is an intentional component here, which as you follow that rabbit hole sort of leads you down into the world of, you know, occultism and magic, which I never thought that I would take seriously. But once you sort of broaden that definition to be not like, you know, people standing on mountaintops throwing thunderbolts at each other, once you broaden that definition to be more about gaming the nature of the universe, changing odds slightly in your favor, because the example that I always hear is, you know, well, why don't magicians win the lottery? Well, if you, you know, reduce the odds from 1,000,001 to 500,001, that's a great increase in your chances, but it still doesn't guarantee that it'll happen. If you start thinking about it that way, and in terms of the way that we can influence our surroundings with, you know, psi phenomena, which do have some degree of verifiability in the laboratory, then you kind of have to say, well, maybe there's something to magic. I mean, we all know these people who just are able to be super confident and just stroll right through life, and we have no idea how they're able to do it. And, you know, I kind of think that there might be some sort of light magic in that sort of magical sense, in terms of like making reality in the image that you have in your head. There might be something to that. You know, that and the fact that when I was growing up in college, I remember, you know, despite being a Christian the entire time, I remember meeting atheist friends, and they were always the smartest and best read person in the room. And I'm like, man, that's confronting. But now that I'm in these circles that I travel in nowadays, it's always the occultist, right? like the magical guy is always the guy who's always the smartest and most read in the room. Not all magicians, but it's typically a magician who is that person, if that makes any sense. Just in terms of having a broad reading of, you know, fringe science and Jung and philosophical constructs, it's typically an occultist now, in my experience. So, you know, I think that, intentionality is something that we take for granted a lot.
So, Josh, that leads me to another question. You know, we're really diving deep here on intention and what that means in the conversation right now around the paranormal. But as far as intent goes with, like, these encounters with these creatures, these djinn, are people purposely seeking out encounters with these things? You know, if someone's going to play with a Ouija board, they're probably going to get some kind of activity, right? If someone is doing a blood sacrifice or something and there's a pentagram involved and some words, I mean, there's obviously intent involved. But are we seeing any intent with people, I don't know if this is the right word, but conjuring these things into their space, or are things just happening on their own?
Well, that's a really, really good question. And I think part of it lies in sort of your interpretation. I have some friends of mine who are convinced that pretty much all paranormal things are not in your head, but they're from your head, if that makes any sense. So they are epiphenomena that are sort of byproducts of these sort of psychic effects. Or even, you know, somehow interfacing with whatever Jungian archetypes are, being the source code of the universe, something like that. I don't know. I don't like that explanation because it's kind of sad that it's just all us. Right. Even if it's us doing weird stuff, it kind of makes me sad that it would just be all us. In terms of people who are, you know, going out and asking to meet Jin or something, I'm sure it happens. I think that the opportunity for those types of personalities to be in places to meet Jin is not that prevalent. And what I mean by that is that the people who are in a position to go to places where there are rumors of Jin being around typically are, you know, Muslims and are typically from the area, and they typically don't mess with this stuff. You know, you don't have a bunch of 15-year-old white kids from Dayton, you know, going out to the local Persian ruins and hanging out and calling it a gym.
Yeah, you're not going to have a paranormal group, you know, take a tour bus out to the site and do an investigation necessarily.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it's almost like with Western secularization, there's this attitude that, well, maybe this stuff doesn't exist, so it's okay to poke at it because it probably is not real anyway. You know what I mean? So that's why you do find people who are willing to spend the night on a fairy fort in Ireland, or who are willing to, you know, hang out in the abandoned mental hospital with the Ouija board. And you're not likely to find people who are in more, you know, traditionally religious, conservative religious cultures who are willing to go out and, you know, mess with this stuff.
Now, that's a good point that you're not like out there poking it with a stick constantly, but you're, you know, you're aware, you're aware, and you respect the stories, you respect the space, and you stay away for the most part. That's a good point.
Well, I mean, it's go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say there's several things on that list that I'm not going to do.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same reason that I don't have a Ouija board in my house and I'm not going to, you know. I think that probably 80% of these scary, spoopy Ouija board stories are, you know, people, somebody's controlling the planchette and, you know, whatever. But I do think there's a subset that is genuinely anomalous. And I think that I don't want to take the chance of that. You know, I would imagine that a Ouija board is kind of like going through a bad neighborhood with your windows down or something. Like, just don't do it, you know. you know, it reminds me of something that somebody who was younger, so not young, but younger, said to me when I was in Ireland. And they're like, you know, of course I don't believe in fairies, but I'm scared of them. You know, so it's that sort of risk mitigation system where, you know, it's like, no, I don't believe in fairy folklore, but I'm not about to be caught dead, you know, in the middle of a fairy fort at midnight, you know.
It's like a coping mechanism, almost like I'm not going to admit, because if I do, then that makes it a little bit more real.
Well, right. And then, you know, I mean, you can imagine, again, if there is a reality to magic, which really means that there's a reality to consciousness phenomena, which is the one hill in the paranormal that I will die on, because there's, like I said, laboratory research at the 6 and 7 sigma level, which means that, you know, if you engineer something at the 7 sigma level, and I'm sorry if I'm getting this wrong, anybody, but this is a pretty close approximation of what it means. If you engineer something at the 7 sigma level, it means that the part will fail like 1 out of a billion times or something along those lines. And you have these insane statistical thresholds for some of these, for some of this laboratory psychic research. Daryl Bim, Dean Radin, you know, a lot of different people, to say nothing of some of the anecdotal stuff that other people have, you know, collected. If these psychic effects that we all have are actually real, then who knows how much, you know, years and years of hearing about this in your culture, how much, you know, you might actually manifest something yourself, you know, or you might, you know, even if it's something as simple as, you know, oh, I went there and now I'm sick. I don't know why I'm sick. You know, well, you could be making yourself sick with your mind. Like, that's literally a thing. Placebo and nocebo, like, are real things. I don't know. I guess that's where I fall on a lot of this stuff, is that I don't know if any of the interpretations of these things are what's going on, but I do think that genuinely anomalous things happen, and I think they probably happen to us a lot more than we realize. You know, I mean, like, you know, you're home alone and you hear a noise, stop, you don't hear it again, you say, oh, it's nothing. Well, what if that was a ghost fart, you know? And I don't know, but like, but, you know, it's just, I think we write off a lot of stuff, where I like to think that we write off a lot of stuff that actually is strange because we just can't, you know, verify it or investigate it.
Yeah, and you know, along the lines of what you were saying, the measurable stuff. So there's the Center for Noetic Science. They've shown there's measurable stuff when people fast together, they pray together, they sing hymns together, or meditate together. And then, you know, there's another angle out there with the Schumann resonance, and there's kind of like this rhythm or resonance of the earth that can be measured. And that when people kind of pray together, there's a different like level that happens with that as well. So meditation, praying, all those things on the positive side. So if you're, you know, to say, you know, that all that is possible on the, in a positive way, well, I think the inverse is true as well.
Well, and there's also stories about people, they've done tests, laboratory tests, where they have plants in different rooms, and one of the plants in one room is spoken to kindly and, you know, praised and talked to kindly and with a soft voice, and the other plant is, you know, chastised and yelled at and very angry, and there's a physical difference with those plants. Even though the nutrition is the same, there's a physical difference in those plants on how they turn out depending on their environment. It's kind of an interesting tie-in there.
Yeah, I really, really love those sort of experiments. And I really wish that I would think that the next step in an experiment like that would be to like, okay, so we've established that, you know, verbalizing this can have a measurable impact on the plant itself. Now let's just like think bad thoughts of the plant and see what happens then, you know? And that's what I always find sort of confronting about that research. It's like, what does it say about those of us like me who are self-loathing, you know, who always talk ourselves down and like, you know, beat up on ourselves? Like, what is that? What are we doing to our health when we do that? You know?
Exactly.
You know, I just had a thought. This is weird. So there's that whole, I don't know if you've heard about when water gets prayed over, it creates, yep, a different shape crystal. So they've actually been able to show that in a lab, that they've been able to kind of show this. And I was just thinking in my head, like in transition there, I was thinking, man, so if our bodies are how much percent water, you know, if you have ill intent towards another person or yourself, maybe it's changing structurally. Who knows?
I mean, I totally think that is the case. I mean, just like I was talking with my wife, because she was talking about how she had heard some research about how the chemical makeup of tears is different depending on, you know, if it's happy tears versus sad tears versus angry tears, like the actual chemical structure of the tear is the water molecule is different. And I tried my best, man. I tried my best to find it like fascinating and new, but I'm like, yeah, of course. this is something people have talked about. And you gotta ask yourself, you know, just like we've been talking about, if you're made of water, like what, 70-80% of us is water, you know, what effect do these negative thoughts have on us? If they can have an effect on the structure of water in a cup, you know, it's and the thing that kills me is that. You talk to people about this and they'll say, well, I'm sure there's some way that it's, you know, the research is faulty. So I'm sure there's some way. It's dumb. You know, it's just a stupid idea. It can't be that way. And you're like, no, listen to what I'm saying. Listen to what I'm saying. Like, this is, people are doing this under pretty rigorous controls. I think it was Russell Targ, you know, one of those old Project Stargate guys who always crops up in the literature research. Maybe it was Hal Putoff. I can never keep the two of them straight, or maybe it was somebody else. Anyway, one of that crowd, what said that there was more evidence for the existence of psi phenomena than for the efficacy of ibuprofen in terms of how many studies have been done. But it's just, it has to break through this stigma that it never can. And that's why we just don't accept it. But I mean, you even talk to people who are skeptical of this sort of thing, and everybody's had something really strange happen to them, even if it's as simple as, you know, telephone telepathy.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. A good point. I think about that too. Like these, they know that Tylenol works, but they're not 100% sure how it works. Yeah, it's on like every shelf.
Yeah, it reminds me of I was having a talk with a family member. I was like, you know that they don't know why we sleep, right? He was like, yeah, they know why we sleep. We sleep to repair our nerve cells and this and that and the other. And I'm like, no, but they don't know why that needs to happen and why that happens that way. Like why we have to enter a state of consciousness. But they couldn't wrap their head around it. Like it's the fact that we enter another state of consciousness that allows our body to do these things. They couldn't really wrap their head around that meaning. They're like, no, we sleep to repair our bodies and to, you know, to keep our brains healthy. And it's like, no, you're saying that's why we sleep, but it's not why we do the thing that is sleep. You know?
Right. Right. I kind of wanted to revisit that idea of, kind of bringing things into reality from, you know, is it because we're thinking of it? There's, you know, of course the Slender Man type thing, like, was it something that was kind of conjured from the collective mind? Or, the other thing is kind of the pale crawlers or a rake. Mm, like that's mm-hmm. kind of something that like, wasn't really around or popular, or maybe it just wasn't attributed to the same thing, you know, the way it was classified or, identified.
Yeah, you know, I think that you'll probably be able to find an antecedent for any of these things if you sort of turn your head and squint a little bit. Which is why sometimes I'm like, well, you know, this whole idea of tulpas, of thought forms, like I get why it's important, and I do think that there's something to it. We can talk about that if you want to, but like at the same time, the paranormal literature is so filled with all sorts of crazy things that you can find analogs for a lot of these things. And what's more, if something like the Jungian collective unconscious really is a thing and people pull these images out of, you know, out of thin air, which, you know, I kind of looking at different cultures that have this idea of, you know, the mother, the warrior, again, big famous one, the trickster, and they have all these shared attributes, it sort of implies that there is a reality to this collective unconscious idea, then, you know, whatever this tulpa is, whatever Slender Man is, has just been hanging out there forever, and he pops in every now and then, or has been popping in every now and then as well. So, you know, I don't know how I got off on tulpas, but, you know, I think there's obviously something to the idea of thought forms and of people being able to create, well, just like we were talking about earlier with, you know, have mental effects, being able to generate certain phenomena. You know, you look at stuff like the Philip experiment, a bunch of Canadian parapsychologists who made up a fake backstory for a ghost and were actually able to manifest the ghost in terms of answering questions about that fake backstory during a seance, really implies that we can sort of make our own ghosts ourselves. So, I don't mean to be dismissive of an idea like that, but at the same time, I think that this stuff's just always been out there, you know, waiting in the fringes for us to call it in.
Yeah, I think about the Lovecraftian stuff, you know, like it's just bizarre, but it's, you know, it's something that people have really latched onto. So.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, so every now and then you run into a bit of fiction that you think gets a little bit closer to the mark than they realize. And I think that some of Lovecraft kind of gets at that, especially this idea that, I think the real good takeaway that probably actually happens in the paranormal with Lovecraft is this idea that we see stuff and we don't know what to make of it. And we go, ah, blah, blah, and we just assign a form to it. But another example of that would be something like, Neil Gaiman's American Gods. Like, I read that and I was like, this sounds like it might be a pretty good example for some of the things that we see, the way that people, you know, create their own, carry their own beliefs in the supernatural with them. And, you know, these things feed off of that belief and, you know, and again, if something like the collective unconscious is a reality, then people don't have ideas. Ideas have people. And that idea was just waiting for Neil Gaiman to pick up on it and put that sort of perhaps, you know, quasi truth out there. Or maybe it's just fiction. I don't know, but I think it's a really useful metaphor for the way that these things might work.
So I guess that leads me to the next question. Is it Mandela effect or a mandala effect?
this is funny. I was talking to someone who was running an art class, and she was like, "We're gonna make mandalas now," and I'm like, it's mandala. So mandala, circular Eastern prayer symbol, Mandela, former figure of, helped obliterate apartheid in South Africa. And the Mandela effect, man, you know, some of it, I think it's this way for everybody, but some of it you read it and it just, it's like, no, it was always that way for me. But some other stuff, man, it's just, it's uncanny. And the one that I cannot dismiss and that I've yet to find somebody who remembers it being the way it is currently is, in Moonraker, the little girl.
I haven't seen it.
I'm getting a blank look. So James Bond film, there was a recurring James Bond villain named Jaws who had these like giant metal teeth that he would like bite cables in half. And in Moonraker, and I've talked to plenty of people who have done this. I've talked to somebody who runs a pretty prominent James Bond podcast. And they're like, no, this is, you're remembering it right, right? And I'm like, no, actually it's not that way. Really weird. So this character Jaws falls back to Earth for some reason. There's this girl that runs up, and she smiles at him. And before she smiles, he's feeling, you know, really self-conscious because he's this giant, you know, literally 7 foot tall dude with these metal teeth. And he feels really self-conscious because he feels like he's a monster with these metal teeth and he's this big hulking brute. And she smiles and she's got like these giant dental braces work. You know, she's got these giant braces and the music swells. Da, 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 da. And that never happened. You go back and watch Moonraker now, and he falls down to Earth. He gets out of whatever he's in. She runs up and she smiles, and there's no braces. Music is there. And the thing about that one that I find really compelling is that was the whole joke. Like, it doesn't work as a joke without her having braces, because the idea is that they would bond over, you know, having metal in their mouth. And, you know, I have yet to find somebody who has seen Moonraker and does not remember her in ages past having braces. It's just, it's uncanny. Now, some of the other ones are a little bit sillier, like Berenstain, like I think most people read those books when they were like two or three. You didn't know how to read them. It could be one thing or the other. The one that I find personally really confronting too, but I won't go to bat for it, is the Shazam, Shaquille O'Neal movie, which I remember distinctly. He had like, I talked to my wife about it. We remember the exact same things about it. You know, it was Sinbad, and he had like this, like, he had a genie hat. That interesting tie in, right, back to our earlier discussion. He had a genie hat, but it was like a mushroom shaped turban. It wasn't like a straight up turban. And we both remember this movie, and you know, everybody says it never happened. Which, you know, when you remember something like that, say we feel that strongly about it, it's like somebody coming back up to you and being like, no, it's always been Star Wars. You know, it's like, no, it hasn't. Like, I know that's not the case. It really is, you know, it's a weird thing, and I don't know what to make of it, you know. If I had to settle on something, which I haven't, you know, I wouldn't feel comfortable really declaring what it means, but I don't think we're hopping dimensions or anything. I think that it probably has something to do with how, you know, amorphous reality is and how we all sort of agree on what reality is, and reality sort of forms around us because we all agree together. So if we all didn't agree on, you know, if we all agreed that dragons existed and we all genuinely believe that, then we might see dragons, right? So that's where you get off saying, you know, a lot of these ancient people or, you know, indigenous people, whatever, might actually be seeing these things because they all agree that they can see these things. It's kind of like, there was a study that was done, I can't remember who it was, but a study that was done where cultures that believe in magic as a thing are more likely to have magical things happen to them. Now, of course, the cynical reductionist says, well, that's because they're willing to entertain that and they're more superstitious. But it's like, no, it actually means that they see more things in their life that they attribute to magic, even when it's, you know, something that's relatively mundane. So it's interesting. It's an interesting idea. Again, everything keeps on coming back to consciousness. Right. Yeah.
Well, and it could be the diaspora of divergent timelines, you know?
Yeah, I mean, who was it who passed? Somebody else passed away recently, and I was like, oh, I thought they were already dead. I can't remember who it was, though.
Prince Philip died the other day.
Well, that was the other day. No, somebody else. Can't remember who else it was. But anyway, or even people that you could have sworn were dead and are. Yeah, it's strange. You know, maybe we are dimension hopping. My problem with dimensions is that I just don't know what it means. And even the people who like to throw out the word dimensions really don't. I don't think they know what it means either. It's just a, because you know, we conceptualize it as like point A to point B, like a place, and it's kind of a place, but really not a place. Like, I don't even think we possess the mental capacity to think about barely to be able to think about the fourth dimension, to say nothing of 5, 6, 7, 8, 24 or whatever.
So this is something that's going to make you laugh. So we've got like 60 mile per hour gusts of wind here. And oh, geez. We've had this is a second time in like a week that we've had it. It's like tearing everything apart, you know, people's trampolines are flying out of their yards, that kind of thing. But so go to use the toilet. I look at the toilet and the water is just kind of surging just like a centimeter at a time. And you're like, why is it doing that? Why is it? And then you think about it and you go, okay, so it's windy, but how is the wind above the ground affecting the water flow? Do you know, like, I'm just looking at it going,
yeah, that's
like,
wild.
It's almost like a distortion of reality. I'm just like looking at it going, how is this happening? And what,
you know, the pressure in your room.
With, I mean, yeah, I guess that's, yeah.
The pressure in your pressure, room with your, yeah. The vent can cause some issues. Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah. Like the pressure increases in your room, the increasing pressure pushes the water out and then a decreasing, I don't know. That's wild though. That is wild.
Kind of through the looking glass, just, you know, a different reflective surface.
Well, yeah, that's the funny thing is that you talk to people about some of these fringe topics and they think that you live in Wonderland or something. And we, a lot of us, most of us, we don't. Like, my favorite people in these fields are skeptical. They say there must be a rational explanation for this or that or the other. In some ways, we're more realists than a lot of other people because we're always looking out for the weird stuff, and we want weird stuff to happen to us. But we're, you know, I don't know about you guys, but whenever something odd happens to me, I'm more likely than a lot of other people to write it off because I'm always thinking in that sort of analytical mode of what it could be, you know, et cetera. But
you know, and as I've just kind of grown older and matured and gotten a little bit more into the whole paranormal, I don't like using that word because that's the easiest word my mind's coming with right now. But I guess what I say is, you know, the more I understand and research and dive deep into the paranormal, like that's more reality to me than what's going on in the world in a way, because I'm like, this is happening all over the world to tons and tons and tons of people. And it's been happening for thousands of years. And most people don't give two rips about that. And so, I don't know. It's one of those things that it's something that I think about quite often. And I'm like, this is kind of my reality right now. This is something that is present in my life right now. And it's becoming increasingly more important.
You are really, really astute in saying that, because a model that fails to explain outliers, or that says that certain outliers are impossible, is a crap model, right? which is why, you know, along with that the whole Psi thing, I often sort of rail against this materialist reductionist idea that matter is the only thing in the universe that matters. Matter matters. And so our materialist model is crap because it can't explain consciousness effects. So that means that it's an improper model. Now, some people, you know, get all angry about it when you talk about it like that, because they say, well, materialism gave us airplanes and, you know, knee replacements and all. And I'm like, well, okay, look, technology did. More appropriately, imagination gave you those things, I think. Imagination and the scientific method, yes, but not materialism, not the idea that the only things that exist are, you know, the idea that your consciousness is a byproduct of the complexity of your brain. Like, that's not the same thing as figuring out through trial and error how to make an airplane fly. And then people also think that, like, well, you know, we have all these great discoveries from materialism. Like, well, you get to keep those. You know, it's like the analogy that I use is, you know, if I add green to a black and white film, I didn't take black away and I didn't take white away, but it's no longer a black and white film, right? we're adding to the possibilities. We're adding to the, you know, to the number of things we can draw upon. And I think that's where we are when we see the fact that, you know, a lot of these laboratory generated consciousness effects are real. The prayer stuff that you've talked about is real. The effect on water, water composition and plants, health. And because those things are real, that means that the whole system of materials and really can't accommodate these things. And I've gotten some arguments with some people who say, well, I think materialism can. Telepathy is just another aspect that we can fit in the materialist paradigm. And I'm like, I don't think it can. And I'd say that with some degree of authority, because I have read like six different scientific philosophers who have said that exact same thing. They've said things like telepathy breaks materialism. Psi effects have no room in a physicalist interpretation of reality. So, and again, if materialism isn't what we're existing in, and psi effects are real, then man, that kicks the door open for everything. Yeah, that's the way inside, in my opinion.
I'm really happy you covered that subject, because just in studying up on you, I listened to, I think it was a podcast in Germany that you had gone on, and the subject of materialism came up, and I was trying to figure out how to place that. I was like, materials, like, is that people that like love to hang on to things? Like, oh, I was like, yeah. But I tried to, you know, deep dive on that and understand it. I think I get it a lot more now that you've given us
So good point, because I've talked to people like in real life and they're like, what material, like people who, you know, I'm a material girl. I'm like, no, not like that. The way that I always explain it is that, you know, materialism, because science is great. I'm not anti-science. I'm anti-scientistic. I'm anti-excluding things because they quote unquote can't be true, right? Materialism says that your consciousness is an epiphenomena of your brain, and an epiphenomena is a byproduct of a complex system. So, sand dunes exist, but sand dunes are an epiphenomena of wind and particle physics of the sand, right? So that's the way I always explain it. So your consciousness is an illusion, which everybody knows is BS, you know? Like, everybody deep down knows that's BS. But, you know, here we are. You know, the model that I prefer is that, is, you know, thinking of your brain like a computer, or like a, you know, television. Before we had the internet, I was used to say television, but, you know, I think computer's a good representation too. What we're doing now is telepathy, right? you don't live in my computer. The website that I go to isn't on my computer. I'm accessing that website that's at a third location. But if I damage my computer, and that damage can be physical or it can be just in terms of the way that it works not working properly, I can't access that website. Website hasn't gone anywhere. The website just can't be accessed by this computer. So if the brain is my computer, then the website, the server, I guess, would be the source of it. But the website is my consciousness. So the website really isn't anywhere. The website's kind of technically lives on the server, but we don't even know what the server is, right? It's a non-locality model of consciousness. And I think that that's, for my, I feel like that's pretty close to what we're dealing with here, but I could be wrong. It's not that I don't insist strongly on really anything. It's just that I object to people who don't entertain things, you know?
Exactly. Well, and what I like about it is that you're not saying this is the way it is. You're humble enough to go, I don't know. Maybe it's this. Maybe this is another aspect to it. For Brett and I, we discuss this all the time. We're saying, you know, we always try to like really like containerize things and go, it belongs here. This belongs here. This belongs here. But our journey, as far as reaching out and having guests on and investigating things, what we've learned, it's more like we're just adding different lenses that we can then access, overlay, interpret and get a good focus on what we're actually trying to figure out.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you. And I mean, you do get to a certain point, you're looking at this stuff that you start to say everything is everything, but not just in the paranormal. I mean, everything is everything. I mean, I'm wearing a cotton shirt. This cotton shirt is not a cotton plant, but it is, you know? and that cotton plant is not, you know, carbon and all the different, you know, chemical composition, molecular composition of it, but it also is. And, you know, depending on how many atoms, electrons and protons are associated with, like, once you break things down into fundamental building blocks, then everything really is everything, you know?
Yeah, and it can permutate into something else. You know,
absolutely.
We've found ways to do that now. Kind of interesting. Well, cool. We've had so much fun. I don't know if I'm kind of tapped out on questions. I feel like I love the way that this like started here and just evolved into something even cooler than we could have even come up with on our own. Did you have anything you wanted to ask or share,
so,
Brett?
Yeah, just one last little thing that I'm just kind of thinking, just because my mind is being activated right now on a couple different levels, but you know, talking about, you know, our topic is genie or jinn and that whole phenomenon, if you will. But, you know, I'm thinking about Hollywood and just how well they execute on showing us these truths, but then also saying this isn't real at the same time, right? We have all the Aladdin movies talking about genies. We have different fairy tales. You know, Disney is huge on that. Marvel, we have aliens attacking Earth. We have portals, aliens coming and attacking the Earth. We have portals, all this different technology, but at the same time, it doesn't exist. Yeah, you know, in the real world, this is just all fantasy. Here's some entertainment for you. But, you know, I'm thinking about just what, and I don't want to sound rude, but it's like we're collectively we're kind of being dumbed down and we're being fed a load of BS, in my opinion. And some people just, they want the entertainment, but they're not also doing reality justice and really understanding, hey, some of this stuff is kind of important in your life, you know, portals and all this phenomenon that's occurred for thousands of years. Do you have any thoughts on that? And how Hollywood is doing what they're doing and maybe why.
Well, you know, there's always the question on how much Hollywood media is a limited hangout, right? How much it's sort of disclosing stuff partially because it wants you to believe it and not believe it simultaneously at the same time. You know, there's always been this group that thinks that the world is being primed for UFO disclosure by Hollywood. I've never really ascribed to that. I can't say that there aren't definitely three-letter agency handlers for these films because they're pretty transparent about that. But I would say that the reason that we see, you know, let's take something that's a good example, right? I have evolved into someone who is pretty staunchly against the extraterrestrial hypothesis for what's going on with UFOs, right? I think it has much more to do with consciousness, consciousness phenomena, perhaps some sort of spirit phenomena, not in that Judeo-Christian sense, but just in a general, almost animistic sense. But you don't see that represented very often, if at all, in Hollywood. And, you know, that sort of goes back to something I speculated about with the government for a while. Everybody's like, oh, you know, the government doesn't want the truth about extraterrestrials to come out. And, you know, I kind of have wondered if the UFO phenomena isn't attributed to extraterrestrials and if it really is consciousness-based, then why would there be so much secrecy? But I tell you what, guys, like, I think which do you think would be more disruptive to the way society works and to a governmental control? That we are not alone in the universe, or that you exist beyond your physical form, and no matter what happens to you in this life, no matter how painful, no matter how bad, you continue on, and you get to go on to the next level. Which is more disruptive to your reality? I can tell you it's B. Like, it really is letter B. You know, a lot of us can conceptualize the former, but not the latter. And, you know, if the power that government has is at the end of the day predicated on violence, because it always is, right? Even a traffic ticket is predicated on the idea that if you resist everything enough, like, the state can take your life or can, you know, can harm you. If that ultimate end game punishment doesn't mean the end of you, if it means that you just, you know, level up, that's a lot more disruptive to control, I think, than the idea that we're being visited by people from the stars. So that would sort of be my take on it. You know, again, while at the same time saying that I could be completely wrong, but that's sort of where I sit with a lot of that, and why you don't see more alternatives to these alternative subjects. You always see, you know, Bigfoot is an ape, you know, ghosts are dead people, which I'm kind of okay with. And you always see, you know, UFOs or aliens. You never see any of these other sort of ideas really getting that sort of mainstream platforming. And then maybe that has something to do with it, to downplay how important consciousness is.
Exactly. Yeah. Until you have all three of those in the same space and you go, what just happened? You know, some of the Stan Gordon stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I you know, I love some of those explanations of, I remember in the foreword to Al Berry and Ann Slate's Bigfoot book, John Green says, you know, well, if UFOs and Bigfoot are seen in the same place, I would prefer to imagine that the aliens are simply investigating the Bigfoot. And like, let's unpack how many assumptions are in that sentence, right? That's a lot. And like, you know, Tim said it best, you know, it's strange to see a UFO. It's strange to see Bigfoot. How many orders of magnitude stranger is it to see them both, you know, literally together or in, you know, close time frame? Like, it should be astronomically high, and yet we have more accounts of that than people realize. You know, and you also don't see UFOs investigating gorillas or chimps, so.
Right, they're not showing up at the zoo. Not too often, I don't think.
Yeah.
Well,
those monkeys that were sent in space, right? Maybe they're being returned in a little bit more advanced form.
It's Planet of the Apes all the way down, man.
That 80s movie, Project X, you know, that was a good one. So, just wrapping up here, I'd really appreciate your time. We appreciate your mind, and I like this interaction, being able to see you access your mind and understand that there's a lot there. It goes deep. There's a lot to access, but I did want to give you an opportunity to share, to plug your work and tell people where they can find you and find your work.
Yeah. JoshuaKutchin.com. JoshuaKutchin. I can spell my own name. Thank you. JoshuaKutchin.com. Has links to all my interviews and, my books. there's a blog there. Someday I'll start writing regularly for the blog, but right now I'm just concentrating on getting more books out. So I am the author of 5 books, A Trojan Feast, The Food and Drink Offerings of Aliens, Fairies, and Sasquatch, The Brimstone Deceit, which is all about smells in the paranormal, Thieves in the Night, which is a brief history of supernatural child abductions, and the 2-volume Where the Footprints End, High Strangeness and the Bigfoot Phenomena with Timothy Grinner. Probably in the next month or two, we'll be releasing a collection of essays that I have edited. And I'm also, I contribute, fairy films. So films that are about fairies and also films that are not about fairies, but have all the fairy motifs in them. Excited about that. That's forthcoming soon. No official release date, but that should be, people should be able to find that pretty soon.
Awesome. We're looking forward to it. We really appreciate you, and tell your family thank you for letting you share some time with us. We appreciate it.
Absolutely, guys. A lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Lost River Legends. If you enjoyed this episode and you would like to help support the podcast, please share it with others and consider subscribing. Here at Lost River Legends, our primary focus is delivering unique topics, amazing guests, all paired with top-notch production value. The Earth we live on has many hidden secrets, countless paranormal stories, and is filled with amazing, curious humans who are trying to find answers to life's questions. Here at Lost River Legends, we are no different. We believe an active curiosity to the unknown is ingrained in the human experience. We hope you'll join us on our journey to explore the lost legends of the Earth by listening to past and future episodes. Until then, James and I wish you health, happiness, and a curious mind. And remember, the clock of life is ticking away. Don't waste another moment and live your best life.